Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. You know, one of the challenging things about the Trump era is simply the glut of news pouring out of Washington. It's just really hard for many of you, I know, to keep up with things happening that you would like to know about, that are actually important to know about, and that aren't the Russia investigation, when it seems like every day there's a dominant or dramatic headline story on Mueller and Russia or on something else that draws the attention away from everything else, like the U.S.-North Korea summit yesterday. So we're going to start today in a different kind of way with seven things in national politics that are worth knowing and some phone calls from you on one or two of them. And the person who can be our guide for this is USA Today Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page, who's always got her eye on many moving parts. She alone, as somebody said, to paraphrase somebody, she alone can look in seven directions at the same time. So, hi, Susan. Thanks in advance for this, and welcome back to WNYC.
I feel like I'm getting set up for failure here, Brian.
Only for success, for extraordinary success. The greatest guest appearance ever. And our seven things, listeners, are how Scott Pruitt's EPA just decided not to look at 10 toxic chemicals getting into the air and water. You know, while there's media focus on Pruitt's personal scandals, there's much less on the policy changes he's making. Another environmental story, how President Trump is trying to make your tax dollars bail out coal and nuclear plants that are failing in the market. Also, why 95% of Senate Republicans might think Trump's new tariffs are unconstitutional but won't say so out loud. Yesterday's seemingly opposite election results in Wisconsin, South Carolina, and Virginia, or are they really opposite in their implications for the midterm elections? We'll touch on maybe the worst thing about the Trump-Kim summit, and surely there were good things about negotiating down a nuclear threat, but maybe the worst thing about the summit and has nothing to do with nuclear weapons. How Attorney General Jeff Sessions is reinterpreting political asylum to send battered women back to their abusers, and how moderate Republicans tried but failed yesterday to save DACA, but it still might work. So that's a lot, and here we go. Item number one, let's start with the political asylum story for victims of domestic abuse, because this is the one I'll explicitly invite calls on. Susan, can you explain what the practice is now and what the Attorney General wants to change?
So the Obama administration had expanded somewhat the definition of asylum, people eligible to seek asylum in the United States, to include victims of domestic abuse or gang violence. And this was especially important to women from Central America. There was really a surge of women who came here seeking asylum, saying they were being abused by their husbands and their government would not protect them, or that they and their families were the victims of gang violence that put them in fear of returning to their homes. So what Attorney General Sessions did on Monday was change that definition. He said that that is no longer generally grounds for seeking asylum. And he has, by the way, the power to do this. This is something the immigration courts have been enacting, but the immigration courts are not part of the judicial system. They're part of the Justice Department. So he has the power to change these rules on his own.
Sessions' language was, an alien may suffer threats and violence in a foreign country for any number of reasons relating to her social, economic, family, or other personal circumstances, yet the asylum statute does not provide redress for all misfortune. Are you familiar with the statute enough to know what it says?
Well, the statute that provides for asylum has various grounds that people can come to the United States and seek shelter, basically, to stay here legally because it is dangerous for them to go home. And the grounds that everyone accepts are religious persecution, for instance, or racial persecution. But the grounds that have been in flux in recent years have been things like domestic violence, gang violence, LGBTQ people. These are cases where the the provision that allows asylum to be granted to some people is subject to interpretation.
And immigrants' rights groups and anti-domestic violence groups, and I think this is the issue that maybe we'll land this in court, I don't know. But they argue against sessions like this, that domestic violence is the responsibility of every government to prevent or enforce laws against when it happens. So some women from countries where the government isn't taking the crime seriously have grounds for political asylum. It's not just personal and private. So callers, you can weigh in on this if you would like to. Should our asylum law be interpreted to include domestic violence as a rationale for asylum when the home government is not protecting the victim? Should domestic violence be seen as a private matter? Or is it ever a political one? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And we'll just say that same policy, though we won't talk about it at the moment, also applies to people fleeing gang violence. Sessions interpreting that as a private, not political or failure of government issue that should lead one to be granted political asylum. So listeners, what do you think, particularly about the domestic violence piece in this respect? 212-433-WNYC. And who knows, maybe somebody listening, is anyone listening who ever got asylum status based on domestic violence? 212-433-9692. If so, tell us your story. All right, item number two. Yesterday's seemingly opposite election results, or are they, in states including Virginia, Wisconsin, and South Carolina. Susan, let's start with Wisconsin. Did you see there was a special election for state legislature where a Democrat won in a district that Trump carried in the presidential by 17 points?
Yes, and this is part of the effort by Democrats to gain control of the state Senate in Wisconsin. It's one more step in that direction. It's a district that had gone 17 points for Trump, I think even bigger, I think maybe 23 percentage points for Scott Walker in the last gubernatorial election, so definitely a red district. And yet here's one where we see the energy of Democrats and possibly the discouragement of Republican voters having an effect on that special election.
And in Virginia, Democrats have now nominated women as of yesterday in all four House races where Republican seats might be vulnerable. Can you tell us some of what happened in Virginia yesterday?
Well, Virginia is interesting, you know, and it's definitely one of those states where Democrats hope to have big gains in their effort to win control of the House of Representatives. The key district, or the district we're looking at most, is a district very close to where I'm sitting in Northern Virginia, the 10th District. State Senator Jennifer Wexton won. There had been a lot of competition for the Democratic nomination. There had been a lot of competition for that nomination because the seat is held by Barbara Comstock, a Republican. That is a district that is full of college-educated folks, some of whom voted for Trump last time, but who have swung as a group. That demographic group has swung Democratic since the inauguration, and a lot of women, professional women, have been sort of energized. So that is seen as one of the key races this year. Barbara Comstock had other trouble in the Republican primary. She had a perennial candidate running against her for the nomination. She's been elected twice to Congress from that district, and yet the perennial candidate got almost 40% of the Republican vote, and that was seen as a warning sign that she has trouble on her right flank with Trump voters, while she also has trouble on her left flank with people who are turning to the Democratic Party.
And I guess a little related to Republicans having trouble on both their right and left flank if they're not Trumpy enough, here's the sort of opposite one from Virginia and Wisconsin. In a South Carolina Republican House primary, Republican Congressman Mark Sanford, who has criticized Trump, lost to a challenger endorsed by Trump at the last minute. In fact, in a tweet on his way home from the summit with Kim. What happened there?
Well, so here's the question. Did Trump help Katie Arrington win, or did he see that she was going to win, and so he jumped on her bandwagon?
Uh-huh.
I think that's kind of an open question. But Mark Sanford was in trouble in South Carolina with the Republican establishment there because he's been critical of President Trump on several fronts, on tax returns, on tariffs. He's been one of the very few Republican members of Congress who were running for re-election who were willing to criticize the president, and he lost the nomination.
And so how do you put these three things together? It looks like Democrats rising, particularly suburban and suburban female Democrats rising from the Wisconsin and Virginia results, but also the Republican Party, based on the Mark Sanford result, moving to a point where, in a lot of places, you better support Trump and Trumpism.
You know, I don't see mixed messages here. I think the message is the Republican Party is Trump's party. The voters in that party are punishing candidates who have criticized the president. The race is to see which Republican candidate can embrace the president more closely. That is clearly a theme we saw yesterday. We saw it a week earlier in the Alabama primary when another sitting member of Congress lost the Republican nomination, didn't win the Republican nomination, now heads into a runoff. So that's what you see happening with the Republican Party. With the Democratic Party, there is a lot of energy, and this rise of women candidates has been unprecedented. You know, in terms of nominations so far, just under 50% of the Democratic candidates who have won these primaries have been women. We've never seen percentages like that before.
And this relates to the dramatic moment on the Senate floor yesterday from Republican Senator Bob Corker, which we're going to play in a minute. But let's take some of the calls that are coming in on the question, should domestic violence be grounds for political asylum? Jeff Sessions says, no, never, which is a change from Obama policy. Elsa in Long Beach, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elsa.
Hello. I'd just like to point out that we don't do a very good job of that here in the United States. Here on Long Island, many women have been murdered by their husbands or boyfriends where they had an order of protection and simply nothing was done about it. So I'm not sure we can straighten out the problems of the world when we are still so negligent here.
And so your argument would be before we could take in women on those grounds from countries that are more negligent than us, let's say, we have to improve domestic enforcement and prevention?
I think we need to show that we actually take it seriously here. I don't believe we do.
Elsa, thank you very much. Nicholas in Asbury Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicholas.
Yes, hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
You have a story out here.
I do. I work very closely with a few artisan groups in Guatemala, and through that work, I have become very close with a particular family. One of the members of that family was a victim of horrible domestic violence. Her life was almost ended multiple times. She had no help from the government, local, state, or otherwise. Being an indigenous Mayan woman, she unfortunately is treated like a second or third class citizen there. And she had to flee to come to the U.S. And I understand why she did it. And now I'm very scared for her case because she might be losing that kind of protection, which exists under the law.
And does she is there something that the United States could do? Or do you know how she would go about proving it?
Yes. So she has paperwork, police reports from her time in Guatemala, from the many times she tried to get her ex-husband arrested, and it never happened. That was going to be the basis for her asylum case. And without using this woman's name, I'll tell you her case, Brian. When she got arrested at the border and then was released and got a pending asylum case, Obama was the president, and I was encouraging her to try to seek asylum under domestic violence protection. But since I'm pretty sure she's gone underground, and I understand because with the way things are now, she probably wouldn't get the asylum that we thought she would have gotten years ago.
Nicholas, such a relevant story. Thank you very much. Pat in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I, too, was a victim of domestic violence in the 1970s. before there was much awareness of it, and the courts here were also complicit. I was more or less considered my husband's property to do with as he pleased. I want you to know, I am sympathetic to immigrants wanting asylum. However, as the lady from Long Island stated, we do a very poor job here in this country also. It's very complicated, but I just wanted to tell you my story. I didn't seek asylum in another country. I had to live through it. I eventually escaped it and built a much better life. But neither here nor there.
Did you hear the previous caller talking about the failure of the government in Guatemala in the case of the woman that he was describing, which I think he would argue is a much worse level of government failure, and it's contemporary, than that woman or that you, if this were to happen to you today, would find here?
Well, I tell you, when you have a rifle pointed at you and your four-year-old son and you're cornered in the kitchen, I don't know how much worse it could get. I did get an order of protection, but he was told to leave town with his gun, and this was in New York, but of course it was the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And
it makes you land on the side of don't let people in for reason.
I guess I'm not saying that, but I guess what I am saying, and we all know that once this is allowed, is there a way of actually proving that these women's mm-hmm. lives are in danger? Or is this a convenient way to get through the... And I don't mean to be cynical.
No,
I'm a former teacher. I taught children of Latino descent. I know their family stories. I'm very sympathetic.
And I understand what you're saying, Pat. And Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief from USA Today. It's interesting because our board is really divided on this, and about half the people are calling on the side of saying, you know, of course there should be a provision for this. If, like the caller Nicholas said about the woman he knows, if they have something like a police report, if they can prove it. On the other hand, a lot of people skeptical and saying, oh, this is just another excuse to get into the country. So it seems like Sessions, if our caller board is divided, maybe Sessions is on at least politically solid ground.
Well, I think this is very consistent with what the Trump administration has tried to do generally on immigration, which is tighten the rules and reduce the flow of immigrants, especially illegal immigrants. And the one of the things that happens when you seek asylum at the border is you're treated differently than you are if you don't seek asylum. If you seek asylum, you don't immediately get it or not get it. There's a legal process, but you're generally released into the United States. You're allowed to live here legally while your case is being considered. And I think that General Sessions' view is that this has led to abuses as immigrants have become more aware of how the U.S. law works.
Let's go on to item number three, why 95% of Senate Republicans might think Trump's new tariffs are unconstitutional but won't say so out loud. We're going to play that dramatic soundbite from Republican Senator Bob Corker yesterday, or a minute of it anyway. But can you set this up for us?
So the important thing to remember is Senator Corker is not seeking re-election, and that has freed him to speak out against President Trump in a way that most Republican senators have been unwilling to do, even on something like tariffs, where there is a long history of the Republican Party being in favor of free trade. The president's decision to impose tariffs on aluminum and steel against our allies, against Canada and Mexico and the European Union, was something that I think if they could speak behind a dark screen, Republican senators would say they oppose. But when you force them to stand up and be counted, there have been very few Republicans willing to do that.
So here is Corker, and his amendment is to assert Congress's constitutional right to decide on tax hikes, including tariffs, Here he is speaking on the Senate floor yesterday.
I would bet that 95% of the people on this side of the aisle support intellectually this amendment. I would bet that. I would bet higher than 95%. And a lot of them would vote for it if it came to vote. But no. Gosh, we might poke the bear. It's a language I've been hearing in the hallways. We might poke the bear. The president might get upset with us as United States senators if we vote on the Corker Amendment. So we're going to do everything we can to block it. To block it. If people don't like it, they can vote up or down. People can vote up or down, but no. The United States Senate right now, on June the 12th, is becoming a body where, well, we'll do what we can do, but my gosh, if the president gets upset with us, then we might not be in the majority. And so let's don't do anything that might upset the president.
Bob Corker yesterday. Is there any reporting, Susan, to back up that he's right about the public position versus private position of Senate Republicans?
Well, I don't think there's something to back up the idea of 95%. I think that's a number he's making up out of his head. But it is, there is no doubt that a majority of Republican senators support free trade. And the president's imposition of these tariffs are particularly controversial because he's doing them on national security grounds, which is a provision that I think many people think does not apply when you're talking about these trade deals with Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. So, Senator Corker was speaking before Republicans knew that Mark Sanford was going to lose the primary last night. If he thought it was hard yesterday to get Republican senators on board, yeah, it would be harder today.
Right. Though we should point out that he raises a legitimate constitutional question, which is that generally Congress has to pass tax and tariff hikes. The exemption where the president can do it unilaterally is if there's national security grounds, and Trump is claiming national security grounds on steel and aluminum because they're used in weapons. But some of the pushback is that he's putting tariffs on Canada and Europe, our allies who have only helped in the past to make sure that we have the weapons that we need. And so the whole thing doesn't make logical sense, and therefore it shouldn't make constitutional sense. That's Sanford's argument, just so people know what the constitutional issue is that he's raising that's not getting a lot of attention.
Yes, and of course the president cited national security grounds in his official action, but on Twitter, when he talked about why he did this, he talked about Canada's tariffs on dairy products in the United States as being the motivation for him to take this action.
And with my guest, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, we're going down seven things from national politics that you may not have heard in the last day because there are too many items for the news to really cover or for people who are trying to keep up with things to really pay attention to. So we're going down a number of them. And we're not going to dwell on the North Korea summit because that's the one that at the moment is burying every other story. But here's one thing. Arguably the worst thing from the Trump-Kim summit. And we acknowledge that peace talks are good things, and we are now further from war with North Korea than we were before. We talked about that at length on yesterday's show. But life is complicated, and here's arguably the worst thing from the Trump-Kim summit, and it has nothing to do with nuclear weapons. It has to do with the safety of North Koreans from their dictator's horrendous human rights record that the UN calls one of the worst in the history of the world, with tens of thousands of people sent to gulags, an assassination of rivals, even including family members of Kim, and mass starvation of groups of his people as a political weapon. But at the summit, Trump called Kim a talented leader. So when Trump took questions from reporters, he got one asking basically, how can you call him a talented leader when he does these things to his people and it's been so well documented? And the president said,
well, he is very talented. Anybody that takes over a situation like he did at 26 years of age and is able to run it tough. I don't say He was nice, or I don't say anything about it. He rented. Very few people at that age, you can take one out of 10,000, probably couldn't do it.
Well, most people couldn't commit that level of human rights atrocities. And then later, and maybe you heard that clip, because that was early yesterday from the press conference in Singapore. Then later, he did an interview with Voice of America, and he came back to this again, but in a slightly different way, maybe even worse.
He's smart, loves his people. He loves his country. He wants a lot of good things, and that's why he's doing this.
But he's starved them. He's been brutal to them. He still loves his people.
Look, he's doing what he's seen done. I mean, if you look at it, but I really have to go by today and by yesterday and by a couple of weeks ago, because that's really when this whole thing started.
He loves his people. And yes, if you recognize the voice, that was Greta Van Susteren doing the interview for Voice of America. He actually praised Kim Jong-un for being tough and loving his people as the world condemns him for his human rights record. Susan, I guess, what's the question even to ask other than maybe, can you imagine if Obama had done that?
You know, it's not only that President Trump said that Kim Jong-un loves his people. He also said that the North Korean people love him. He talked about the fervor of their support, which I think struck experts on North Korea as a naive interpretation of the enthusiasm you see for Kim among his own people, given the consequences if you do not show enthusiasm for Kim. You know, there was I covered the news conference yesterday for USA Today from here in Washington. 45 minutes passed at the news conference before the issue of human rights was raised, because President Trump didn't raise it in his comments. It was not raised in the joint statement that was signed by the two leaders. And this is, I think, surprising in that President Trump has raised this issue in the past, criticized North Korea, and it was, I believe, 1 year ago today that Otto Warmbier died, the American college student who was seized in North Korea, was touring North Korea, seized, held 17 months, and returned to his parents in a coma.
And he later died.
Yes.
Let's move on to the two environmental issues not quite making the national conversation because of the few dominant news stories. Scott Pruitt's EPA just decided not to look at 10 toxic chemicals getting into the air and water. And while there is media focus on EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt's personal scandals, there's much less on the policy changes he's making. Can you explain the chemical regulation issue?
So in 2016, Congress updated something called the Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976. And under the Obama administration, this was seen as a way to review chemicals that are readily available in the market that are used in things like shampoo and paint strippers for their toxic effects, for whether they should be regulated or even outlawed. And the first 10 chemicals came up now. They've been reviewing these, but they weren't. This process began under the Obama administration. Now the Trump administration is taking it over. And the Trump EPA is changing the rules about what they look at in assessing whether these chemicals are safe. They're changing the rules in a way that makes them less likely. The review is going to be less comprehensive. It's going to include only the use of these chemicals in the workplace. It's going to make it more likely that they are not subject to additional regulation.
And item number 6, how President Trump is trying to make your tax dollars bail out coal and nuclear plants that are failing in the market. What's the new policy he announced this month on that? And I understand there is some Republican pushback on this one.
So the president is looking for a way to help keep coal plants open. This also affects nuclear plants, but I don't think that's really the motivation for the administration. The president promised during his campaign famously that he was going to help a resurgence in the coal industry, but since he's been inaugurated, 25 coal plants have shut down. And that's because coal plants are no longer seen as profitable. So the administration is looking for ways to make coal more profitable. And the Energy Department is now looking at requiring the purchase of electricity from coal and nuclear plants to keep the grid fully, lots of energy available on the grid, even though they're not profitable. That's not the way the energy industry thinks it ought to go. This will hurt both. This has formed an interesting alliance between fossil fuel industry, which gets hurt by this, and the renewable energy like solar and wind, because it means that these unprofitable nuclear and coal plants are going to get a lifeline from the government.
Here are some, I think we have a call of pushback on the Trump and Kim Jong-un language. Stephen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stephen.
Yeah, I would like to say is that when you're negotiating with Kim Jong-un about nuclear weapons to protect our country, he can't talk about dictatorship and all these kinds of stuff. He won't negotiate with you on that.
That's fair. And I think in fairness, Obama, when he was negotiating the Iran nuclear deal, did not try to bring everything else that would rightly be considered an Iranian atrocity into the conversation. We're having a narrow conversation about nuclear weapons, and that's fair. But, Stephen, does that mean that Trump has to go so far as to call this dictator with one of the worst human rights records in human history talented and go out of his way to say he loves his people?
Yes, I also thought about that, and I decided that maybe Kim Jong-un is watching the TV. And if he sees Trump talking against him, like, you know, bad things, and he's not, like, praising him and say all good things about him, maybe he won't come to the table again. So maybe that's why Trump said all these things, and he doesn't really think so.
Stephen, thank you very much. Susan, one of the things that I saw pointed out was that while Trump was saying all these things that were nice about Kim Jong-un, he didn't say anything nice back about Trump or about the United States or make any of these rhetorical gestures going the other way.
Yeah, it was pretty much a one-way street, although the president quoted Kim as saying he was a great president, different from the other presidents. So we have secondhand praise that may have been made in private. But just to get this, if I could just comment briefly on Stephen's point, I think that is exactly the argument the administration is making, that the cause of trying to bring these nuclear weapons under control is so important that you can't do everything, so you're not going to do human rights. The thing that I think distresses some others, some critics, is that they don't even seem to be raised as even a secondary concern to look at down the road or to just to keep in mind. It seems to be something the United States abandoned in these talks.
And is there any reason to believe, if you know an answer to this, that that kind of language by Trump, other than seeming outrageous to people concerned with human rights in North Korea, would actually have an effect of further empowering Kim to do whatever he does with the people of that country internally?
Well, I think that is the fear of human rights advocates, that if the United States is not even going to raise these issues, then clearly Kim has a free hand to do what he wants. Although the estimates are that he already has 100,000 North Koreans in prison camps. So I don't think he feels very restrained at the moment.
And finally, item 7 out of 7, how moderate Republicans tried but failed yesterday to save DACA, but it still might work. What happened yesterday?
Well, there's been this effort by some moderate Republicans working with Democrats to force a vote on an immigration bill to deal with DACA and other immigration issues through what's called a discharge petition, where they can basically go around the leadership. That has now failed. They kept saying they had enough Republican support to do that. They failed to do that. They are now have a promise from House Republican leadership to have votes on two immigration matters, but there is very little expectation that either bill is going to pass. And in fact, there are some new developments with the administration in a court case where they're seeking a court decision in Texas that would say DACA was illegal. This would be at odds with two other court decisions that would push it to the Supreme Court. And that could mean that the court could stop the enforcement of these competing and conflicting court decisions, which would open the door for the administration to do what they've wanted to do, which is end the DACA program.
So Paul Ryan is going to still get something to the floor?
Well, you're going to have he's promised to have two votes on the floor. One that would be for a conservative measure, one would be for this more moderate measure. But keep in mind that I think no one on any side thinks there's a possibility of either of these measures passing, much less getting through the Senate and signed by the president.
And folks, there are seven things you might want to know more about in national politics, not quite breaking through in many media. Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, our great thanks for your ability to look seven ways at once.
Brian, can I just say one thing?
Please.
This is exactly the dilemma that we have every day, but in the news media, right?
Yes.
There are so many things happening. They're so important. You can't possibly cover them all. And the decision about what you cover and what you don't cover, it is just really hard.
It is. It really is. And that's why we try some experiments like this, and hopefully this worked. In fact, I think, you know, a lot of people are saying this was the greatest guest segment in the history of the world. A lot of people are saying... So we'll see what happens. Thanks, Susan. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.